This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we tell stories about everything here on this show, from the arts to sports, and from business to history, and everything in between, including your stories. They're some of our favorites. Our next story, well, it's one about service, love, and sacrifice. Let's follow Eileen Hall's incredible journey across Europe as she searches for her husband in the middle of World War II. Eileen was a member in the Women's Army Corps, or WAC. We got together with Eileen and her daughter, Sherry, who both live in Canton, Ohio. Here's Eileen.
I'm from Canton, Ohio. I was born in 10/11/23, and my mother and dad had a restaurant in downtown Canton, and we had a hotel up above the restaurant, and that's where I was raised. We lived right across the street from McKinley High School, so all I had to do was walk across the street and go to school. After my mother made it to my high school graduation, and shortly after that, she passed on, and my dad remarried, and I felt very uncomfortable at home with a different mother, really.
And you were working at?
Kempkin Roller Bearing Company, so. It's a long time, that's 75 years ago, you know, so I'm trying to remember. A lot of it I'll never forget, but. And there I met a girl, and we became friends, and we worked in the stationery supply office. And she had a boyfriend from Galion, Ohio, and every time he came up to see her, he brought his brother. So she said, "Do you think you'd mind dating his brother if he brings him up?" And I said, "Oh, no." Well, that was it, because we just melded together, and it's just worked out, so. But he was being drafted, like all the, that he was going to be sent to Oklahoma. So after my dad remarried, I just didn't feel comfortable at home, so I said, I always wanted to go to California, so I said, I think I'll go to California, because I've always wanted to go there, so. I boarded a train and it stopped in Oklahoma. And I thought, well, I'll just see, you know, him while I'm here. So that's as far as I got. We got married. After I was there a few days, we had to go through blood tests and it was really, you know. So, and we were married in a parson's office. And then it wasn't long after that that he was sent overseas. So I thought, well, since I'm married to him, I'll go back home and see what I can do, you know. So I went back home and I decided to enlist in the service. So I went in downtown Canton where they had their recruiting office and told them I would like to join the Army. Well, the Navy I really wanted, but you couldn't get in that one until later. So I decided I'd get in the Army if I could. So even though I was married, I had to get my dad's consent. Because of my age, I couldn't do it unless I had my parents' consent. So I went to where he worked and told him, and he said, well, if I don't do this, you'll do something else crazy. So he signed. He was a World War I veteran. So he signed, and I took it back. And after that, I got into basic training in Daytona Beach, Florida. From there, I was, they said as we were being interviewed, the girls that had already volunteered said, you'll be sorry, you know. And so, but I volunteered for everything, so I always got the pick of things that I wanted to do, so I thought that was a good idea. From there, I was sent to Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia for driver training, and, I led a convoy through Georgia as one of our tryouts, you know, to see how we did. And so, and then we had to go in gas chambers and take off of the gas mask and stay for a few minutes and then go out and catch your breath again. So, and then we had to lay down, and they fired shots over us, you know, to see how we'd react. And then we had to go through other training. Abandoning ship, we had to go, you know, to a top of the ship that would be and go down the sides. And a couple of the girls were just terrified of doing it, so I helped along with them. And then after that was all done, I was sent to Fort Lewis, Washington. And I was only there for a little while. The fellows in the barracks weren't used to having women there. And boy, every time we'd walk out everywhere, shoo, there were guys walking with us. So, but anyway, I volunteered. They asked for volunteers to go overseas. So I volunteered, but there were too many, so I wasn't going to get to go. But at the last minute, one gal dropped out, and so I took her place. And then it wasn't long after that that we were sent to Fort Dix, or New Jersey, and boarded the Queen Elizabeth and headed for France. So on a ship that in peacetime would accommodate two people, there were 24 wacks in one room. And then we went on and we landed at Glasgow, Scotland, in the Isle of Clyde. And there we were met with the Red Cross and the Salvation Army, and they gave us food and till they decided where we were going to go from there. And some of us boarded a train and headed for Sutton Coldfield, England. That's where I was going to be stationed for a while.
And we've been listening to Eileen Hall's journey to find her husband in the middle of World War II. A great backstory. I can't wait to hear more. Sure, you can't either. When we come back, more of Eileen Hall's story here on Our American Stories. Folks, if you love the stories we tell about this great country, and especially the stories of America's rich past, know that all of our stories about American history, from war to innovation, culture, and faith, are brought to us by the great folks at Hillsdale College, a place where students study all the things that are beautiful in life and all the things that are good in life. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale will come to you with their free and terrific online courses. Go to hillsdale.edu to learn more. And we continue here on Our American Stories with Eileen Hall's story. And what an adventurer this lady was, my goodness, and so many other women who served in the war. She wanted to be in the theater and volunteered for it. Let's pick up where we last left off.
Some of us boarded a train and headed for Sutton Coldfield, England. That's where I was going to be stationed for a while. So, that's where I had to drive a Jeep. I went through the motor corps, so I was allowed to drive a Jeep and up to a 2.5-ton truck. So I drove everybody in Sutton Coldfield in England had to list if they had a room available for GIs, because they didn't want the women staying in rooms. They wanted the men to be there. So that's what I did for a while and got them all done. And then I was sent, I drove a major there that four of us were drivers, and we all drove an officer. So I drove a major. So we were on call 24 hours a day for whatever reason they wanted us. So, but I had to drive in the fog so bad that I had to put my foot up. They drive on the left side on the curb, so I would know where I was going. And because of that, my left leg is not as big as my right one. It took that much, it froze, you know, and I had to go back to the barracks, and they put me behind bakery, and so I could thaw out to my leg was so frozen from driving. So we had gone through many air raids at night, and one of the gals said, if I'm going to get killed, I'm going to do it right here. And so the rest of us decided we'd stay together. So that was it, because there were nightly air raids, you know. So after I left England, I went to France and was with the post office there as a driver. So every morning I'd drive into Paris, and the streets were empty except for people going through garbage cans trying to get something to eat, people and dogs. And that's something I'll never forget. And as I drove to the post office that I was be at, just as I drove in, something cracked on the steering wheel, and I couldn't steer it, but I was already there. So I felt that was a blessing, because if I'd done that out in the, you know, out on the streets, it would have been something else. I have faith, and I just felt I'd be protected whatever I did, because if I volunteered for something, I felt that that's what I should do. So I just had a different life than some of the other WACs. But the Battle of the Bulge was going on then, and they were bringing the wounded into the hospital in Paris, and our commanding officer was called from the hospital and asked him to send some WACs down to help. The wounded were coming in so fast. So our commanding officer called me and said, you know, gonna take some WACs to the hospital. So I got a ton and a half truck and loaded it with WACs and drove into the hospital, in front of the hospital, and walked in, and here the GIs are all laying on the floor, and you could just walk sideways. And so we would kneel down and talk to them and take, you know, we all went and talked to each one and asked where they were from and just got them calmed down before. And then they finally found room for them all. So, but when I had time off, I was allowed to take the Jeep, and I became acquainted with two fellows from Iowa. And one was had his left leg amputated below his knees, so he was going to be sent home. And he said he hated to go home without seeing Paris. And I said, well, I'll see what I can do. So I went to my commanding officer, told her the story, and she says, you take a Jeep and show him wherever you want to go. So there were two WACs in the back and me driving and him sit beside me, and I took him all over Paris. So he was, you know, excited about that. And we kept in touch for years after I got home, so. But I got a letter from my husband saying he was going to be sent to the CBI, that's the China Burma. And I thought, and I started crying. And the officer was below me, and she came up and wanted to know why I was crying. And I said, well, my husband's going to be sent to the CBI area. And I said, I'd probably never see him again. And she said, I'll see what I can do. So she got me orders attached to Mark Clark's, but he never knew I was part of his service. So, but that got me to early airport and asked, you know, if anybody was going to Paris. And there was a plane just out there that was going to be going to Italy. And I told my story to the guy at the desk. And so he said, that plane right there, you can get on. So they put down the Bombay doors, and I walked out, and they, one on one side and one on the other, lifted me up and put me in where the gun turret is. And that's how I rode from there to Italy. And I got off of the plane, and I was standing on the road, and I didn't realize right in front of me was the Tower of Pisa, because I didn't realize it was that big, you know. And so I walked out and I started hitchhiking. And along came a British guy in a truck with three soldiers in the back. And one was, they were attending to one. And I said, what happened? She said, he got hurt, but not by fire. I don't know exactly how he got hurt. And they're going into Rome. So they stopped for water, and the driver of the truck had to come back and stand in front of me so I could lean to the back, because the people just came from everywhere and they wanted to touch me. And you know, and I didn't know what to do, so they looked out for me. And then we left and went on to Rome to the Red Cross there, and they put me up for the night. The next morning was a Sunday, so it was church. So I went down and went to church, and after a little while, before church started, a fellow sat down beside me and he looked at my patch. He says, "You're not from around here, are you?" And I said, "No, I told him my story." He said, "I'll see what I can do." So the next day, he had gotten permission from his officer, and he was able to take me from Rome to Milano. And on the way, it started to rain. And the fellow didn't know how to do the top to the Jeep, so I showed him how to do that. And he took me up, and my husband was waiting for me, waiting there. So we had our honeymoon on Lake Como, and I had our own villa attached to a regular one, which is owned now by George Clooney. And I'm sure George Clooney doesn't know it, but I'm going to write a letter to him sometime, if he ever gets it. The Villa d'Este. Yeah, so, yeah, that was the 5th Army rest camp. So we left from Le Havre on the E.B. Alexander, headed for the United States. As we pulled into New York Harbor, all the lights came on, and they took us off the boat and fed us the best Thanksgiving dinner we ever had. So, and from there, we had to go to Fort Dix to get released from the Army. And then I boarded a train for Canton, Ohio. And when I got to Canton, there were my husband and my dad, and just welcomed me home. He got home 7 days before I did. But other than that, why, I think my experience was something that not too many people have the opportunity to experience. So that's my love story. And I love to tell it. So, and thanks for the opportunity to tell it. So that's it.
And that's it. And thanks for the opportunity to let us tell it, Eileen. And what a beautiful story about so many things, particularly just a sheer sense of adventure. Off to Europe to fight Nazis, searching for each other, learning how to drive trucks and tanks, supply lines, to defeat one of the world's worst enemies in history. Eileen Hall's journey to find her husband in the middle of World War II. Her story here on Our American Stories. And we continue with Our American Stories. Previously on our show, we've heard from Steve Stolier, who, as a UCLA student in the mid-70s, convinced Universal Pictures to re-release the classic Marx Brothers movie, Animal Crackers. It's a terrific story, by the way. Go to OurAmericanStories.com and take a look. Stolier would then go on to be Groucho Marx's personal assistant and historian for the final years of the legend's life. Today, we hear from Steve again, still in show business, but excited as ever to be surrounded by stage and screen legends. Here's Steve.
Groucho Marx was just at the top of my pantheon of most admired entertainers. But running a close second was Fred Astaire, Frederick Austerlitz, of Omaha, Nebraska. He doesn't seem as if he would have come from middle America like that, because he's, you know, known for the top hat and white tie and tails. But in fact, he's one of those erudite fellows that came from Nebraska along with Johnny Carson and Dick Cavett and Marlon Brando and a number of other people. I would have given anything to be able to meet him. And in fact, when I was working at Universal Studios in the late 70s, after Groucho died, I got a job working in the Steno Pool from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. every day. And I would be typing episodes of The Rockford Files and Kojak and Beretta and so on. But I loved working at Universal because on lunch breaks or before or after work, I could go wandering around. There wasn't much security at the time. It isn't like now. Plus, I was an employee. And I was always nosing around because of the history of the place. I loved the Universal horror films and all that sort of stuff. The classics, My Mad Godfrey. And so I would keep track of who was guest starring on different shows and if they were filming on the lot. And if I was lucky, sometimes I would be able to cross paths with them. And then of all the unlikely things, I found out that Fred Astaire was going to be guest starring on Battlestar Galactica. Apparently his grandson, his favorite TV show was Battlestar Galactica. And he said, "Grandpa, will you be on that? That would be cool." And so Astaire, figuring, well, I can't deny my own grandson a request like that. So he got in touch with the producers, and they wrote a part for him where he played Dirk Benedict's con man father. On a lunch break, I wandered over to the set, and I watched him shoot a scene inside the spacecraft. And then during a break, he was just sauntering around the soundstage with his hands in his pockets. And I happened to have with me an original still of him in Swing Time, 1936 film. And so I went over and introduced myself. And I said, I want to thank you for all of the magical moments from flying down to Rio to a family upside down and everything in between. Family Upside Down was a TV movie he had just done, co-starring opposite Helen Hayes. So at the time, that was sort of like thanking him for his whole film career. And he said, "Oh, well, my goodness, thank you." And he was happy to sign my photo. And so for one brief shining moment, I got to meet, you know, one of my all-time heroes. So that was in 78. In 1983, 5 years later, I had moved to New York the previous year to write for Dick Cavett, whom I met through my Groucho connection and who hired me away from Universal to write for him at HBO on a short-lived show called HBO Magazine. But then I continued to live in New York and write for Cavett and other things. Astaire and Gene Kelly had both been honored by the Kennedy Center. You see the edited down specials on TV where they have someone from dance and music and literature and they salute them. And the Kennedy Center had a policy where after you've been saluted, they would appreciate it if you would sit down for an interview. Not to be released or broadcast, but just for their library, for the Kennedy Center's official library, to have that for people to be able to access. So Astaire said that would be fine with him, but only if Dick Cavett does the interview, because he had had good experiences when Cavett had his ABC show, and he felt comfortable conversing with him. I was friends with and writing for Cavett, and he knew what an Astaire fanatic I was, as was he. And the Kennedy Center sent Cavett the list of questions they wanted him to ask. And luckily, he gave those to me to rework, because they were asking thesis questions on, you know, compare and contrast the development of tap as an art form from the Irish clog through vaudeville and the influence of the African-American experience. And I knew from previous experience that Astaire is a tough interview subject and he hates analyzing his art. He was very much a I just do it kind of guy. So what I did was I very carefully chopped up their essay questions into more conversational bites so that Cavett could ask him and get information. You know, his answer on how a certain sequence happened, the dance director, Hermes Pan, would come up with an idea and I'd try it out in front of a mirror and sure, great. That would be how he would discuss how a dance step came to be. Kelly, because he was a director and choreographer, Kelly was the opposite. If you said hi, Gene Kelly would say, dance is a three-dimensional medium and film is a two-dimensional medium. So as a director or choreographer, you have to take in that distinction and frame the image such that the two-dimension, you know, he gave those kind of dissertation answers. But for Astaire, it was just, well, sure, great, let's do it. Which doesn't make for, you know, compelling listening. I flew out to L.A. with Cavett to interview both Astaire and Kelly. We were in a limousine. I was in the front seat with the chauffeur, which is just as well because I tended to get nauseated sitting in the back of limousines. And we stopped by Astaire's house on San Ysidro in Beverly Hills. He got in the car and Astaire looked at me and he said, have we worked together before? You look familiar. And I don't know whether he was confusing me with someone else or if he really did remember from when I met him on the set of Galactica. But so on the way to the studio, I'm listening to Cavett and Astaire talking. And Astaire said, Dick, did you look over these questions? And I'm thinking, hee, 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 hee. And Astaire said, some of them are asinine. What was I doing in vaudeville? I mean, for heaven's sakes, that was 50 years ago. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I'm, you know, mentally slinking down in the front seat, thinking, oh God, you should only know what these questions were like before I made them sanitized for your easy digestion.
And you've been listening to Steve Stollier talk about his brush with greatness again when we come back. More of the story of Fred Astaire and Steve Stollier here on Our American Stories. And we're back with Our American Stories and Steve Stollier's story of the time he had the privilege of meeting and working with Fred Astaire. Steve was working for Dick Cavett at the time, and Astaire had just been selected to be honored by the Kennedy Center. Cavett was going to interview Astaire and had asked Steve to rewrite the Kennedy Center's questions, and even so, Astaire still found Stollier's versions of the questions asinine. Let's get back to Steve.
So I was sort of on edge after that because I thought it was going to be this wonderful time and now he's attacking the questions and all that. And I didn't let on that I'd had anything to do with them because I didn't want to be the target of his annoyance. But we got to the studio and as a favor to Astaire to show respect, they had him go into the makeup room first before Cavett to get ready for the cameras. So then he came out in makeup, and then it was Cavett's turn, and the director said to me, will you sit down with Fred and talk to him until Dick is ready? And I thought, oh dear, yeah, sure, I... The next thing I knew, I was sitting in a director's chair next to Astaire in his director's chair and trying to make pleasant conversation with someone who had just torn apart the questions I had carefully crafted and who was, you know, notoriously difficult to draw out. But one of the things I brought up was, you know, this was in 83. It was the same year that the musical My One and Only had opened on Broadway, and I had seen that with Tommy Tune and Twiggy and Honey Coles. And it was basically a loose reworking of the Gershwin show Funny Face, which Fred and his sister Adele had starred in 1927. And I loved it. And I felt like seeing Tommy Tune do some of those intricate tap numbers was as close as I was going to get to seeing a stair dance. And I mentioned that even though the show was filled with a lot of standards, the song, My One and Only, was semi-obscure, but I knew it because I had a record of Astaire and Adele singing that from Funny Face. And I said, so it's interesting because now that song is getting well-known by the average public because of this new Broadway show. So we started talking about new releases of classic songs, and we got around to Puttin' on the Ritz. And he mentioned, he said, last year there was that version by that German fellow, and I must say I didn't care for it. The German fellow was a guy named Taco, and it was sort of a synthesized, mechanized version of Puttin' on the Ritz that got a lot of airplay in 1982. But Astaire said, the way he does it is just boom, boom, boom. Puttin' on the Ritz, boom, boom, Puttin' on the Ritz. I didn't care for it. He said, now when Irving wrote it, meaning Berlin, he wrote it like this. And Astaire started tapping his foot. Da 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 da. And I'm thinking, Fred Astaire is tapping and singing Puttin' on the Ritz, to me, only me, this special moment just from me, I would say dancing as fast as I could verbally to keep him occupied until Cavett came out, but it ended up being this wonderful little pocket of conversation. And then Cavett came out and they started taping, and actually between my having cut the questions up and Cavett's brilliance as an interviewer and conversationalist, he was able to draw Fred Astaire out in that interview and actually got him to talk about a lot of things that were essentially things that I had wondered about that I would have asked Fred Astaire if I ever had the chance. So I put them through Dick Cavett's mouth, and he ended up, you know, at one point he said something like, gosh, Dick, you're making me remember things I hadn't thought about in 40 years, which I took as very gratifying because it was unlocking some of these old memories. One of my questions was, did he ever have an understudy? Because you think about Broadway shows and how unique Astaire was there someone who, if he was sick, would have gone on? And the way Cavett asked it was, he said, for instance, if you were under the weather, did the manager come out before the show and say, we're very sorry, Mr. Astaire can't be here tonight. Instead, please enjoy Leonard Crunchman. That was the name he came up with on the spot, Leonard Crunchman. And Astaire said, oh no, I never had an understudy. No matter what, you just went on, you know. And it was that kind of that trooper mentality. And he said, I remember one time in London, I had a boil removed from my head, and the doctor bandaged it. But I still went on that night, and I had my top hat and this bandaged head. And nobody explained anything. And I guess the people in the audience were thinking, oh, I suppose the old fellow broke his skull or something. And every time I put the top hat back on top of my head, it hurt. But, you know, you just went on. So it turned into this really fascinating conversation. I mean, Astaire was in his mid-80s at the time and just beginning to slow down a bit. I mean, he wasn't as lively as he was on the ABC Cavett shows. And, you know, there was no audience, there was no band. It was just this conversation. Then the following day, we went over to Gene Kelly's house, and he was the absolute opposite, because he was able to dissect and come at his films and the dance sequences and the combination of ballet and tap and the athleticism and the choreography. Because I had researched him when I was in New York, HBO at the time was located in the Time Life building, so I had access to Time and Life magazine's archives, and they would have bulging manila folder files with stretched out rubber bands trying to keep them from exploding. And inside would be old clippings and old photos and stuff. You know, it was like a morgue of old newspaper and photographic things from previous stories. This was, you know, I hasten to add, before Google, so you couldn't just go to IMDb or Wikipedia or something. But I had this rare access. And in the file for Gene Kelly was a story about when he was working on the 1942 Cover Girl with Rita Hayworth. The music was by Jerome Kern. So there was one news story that said that after filming was completed, Jerome Kern presented Gene Kelly with a silver plate, and that was engraved "To GK from JK" in honor of Cover Girl. And so after Cavett had finished interviewing Gene Kelly, I thought, this'll floor him that I know this bit of trivia. And so I said, do you still have that plate that Jerome Kern gave you after Cover Girl? And I expected him to laugh or something, and instead he's got this scowl on his face. And he said, "Where did you hear about that? That was stolen from me some years back. And I've never seen it. There was a theft at my house. How do you know about that?" And all of a sudden, I was like, you know, sitting in a chair with the cops going over me with a third degree and a bright light. And I said, it was in your file at the Time Life archive of the thing. And I think he was placated. But it was a strange note to end on, because I don't know that he ever completely got over that trace of suspicion. That the one thing I brought up that I thought would put a smile on his face instead triggered his Irish anger. But it was still a great afternoon to be sitting at the feet of Gene Kelly and listening to him talk about his career. And only one day after spending the afternoon with Fred Astaire, so I had, in one visit back to L.A. from New York, I had managed to spend time with two of the greatest dancers that have ever appeared on film.
And great job, as always, by Robbie on the production and everything else. It's a terrific story. And Steve Stollier, my goodness, what a great storyteller. Steve Stollier's story, his two brushes with greatness, here on Our American Stories.